Welcome to the Promise Institute podcast, where we share critical conversations on human rights, a production of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA Law. Be sure to stay tuned after the episode to learn about ways to follow the Institute and to support our work.
So hello and welcome to this series of podcasts in which we'll be talking about the proposed new international crime of ecocide. The series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium or collection of papers under the title An International Crime of Ecocide, New Perspectives, which examines ecocide from a whole range of different angles, such as how ecocide might contribute to environmental justice and reparations for climate harms, how it relates to rights of Indigenous peoples and rights of nature, how it might best be brought into law, as well as a number of case studies, including Jamaica, Brazil, and wildlife crime. The symposium papers can be found on the website that we host along with the Stop Ecocide Foundation and the Human Rights Consortium at the University of London, ecocidelaw.com. My name is Kate McIntosh from the Promise Institute for Human Rights, and today I'm with authors Daryl Robinson from Queen's University, Canada, Lisa Aldring from the University of Amsterdam, and Luke Johnson from the University of Northumbria in the UK to explore the mental element of the crime. What level of knowledge, intention, or recklessness as regards the consequences of their actions must someone have in order to be guilty of the international crime of ecocide? Before we get started, I should say that all of the papers in the symposium engage, although not necessarily exclusively, with the definition of ecocide proposed in June 2021 by the independent expert panel convened by the Stop Ecocide Foundation. I was a member of the panel, which was chaired by Philippe Sands and Dior Falsau, and more information about the panel, along with its proposed definition, can be found on ecocidelaw.com. So, Daryl, I'll turn to you first. You've thought quite a lot about how to frame this crime. Why is it hard to define ecocide?
I think there's about three main ingredients for any good definition of ecocide. One, they have to have some kind of impact threshold. What level of environmental destruction is serious enough to warrant international attention and the labeling as a crime? So that's one, is the impact. Number two is the wrongfulness. In some way, we need to line ecocide up with environmental principles to identify the uses of the environment that are egregious and irresponsible. And then the third one is the fault element. What is it that the person has to know? Was it their purpose or was it negligence? For today, we're really focusing on that third ingredient, the fault element. But all three of them are really difficult, interesting challenges to figure out.
And at least three conversations that we could have about all of those. But as you said, today we're going to look at the fault standard and in particular at the papers that you and Lisa authored and that Luke authored about this particular element. So Luke, let me bring you in for listeners who aren't criminal lawyers, explaining what we mean by the mental element or the fault element.
Within the law, when defining a crime, you've got essentially two fundamental sort of principles which make the person guilty. First is the actus reus, so the physical act of a crime, the doing, essentially. And then you've got the mens rea, so the mental element. Mens rea is Latin for the guilty mind of a perpetrator. It's an inspection into the mindset of the accused at the time of carrying out the act. So dating back to Roman law, the mens rea is now sort of cornerstone of the Western criminal legal system, with the Latin phrase, actus reus non fati nisi mens sit rea. And that could be completely wrong, but it's essentially along those lines.
Great Latin accent you've got there.
Well, I definitely didn't learn it in school. But yeah, essentially what this phrase means is that the act is not culpable unless the mind is guilty. And therefore, when investigating a crime, we need to take inspection into the mindset of the accused. But as the law evolved, what we found is that there is essentially not one particular mindset that is required, but that this idea of mindset and culpability is essentially a spectrum where there's different varying degrees of mens rea. So the first and the most serious is when a person acts purposefully or with intent. Did this person intend to engage in conduct, and was the purpose of his act what the eventual consequence was? You've then got when a person acts knowingly. So this isn't necessarily looking at whether the defendant had a purpose to achieve, but was the perpetrator aware that there was, he knew essentially that was the likely consequence and it was virtually certain that this would result. As you come further down the spectrum, you've got this idea of recklessness, where a person foresees a risk that the act may occur, but the defendant essentially consciously disregards this risk and carries on with the conduct nonetheless. And then finally, you've got this idea of negligence. So negligence doesn't necessarily look at the mindset of the perpetrator, but more what did the perpetrator miss? And did the perpetrator show a culpable disregard for a risk of, you know, an act occurring? So in this context of ecocide, did the defendant was the defendant consciously unaware of a potential risk, and does that risk that he missed make him culpable? So they're essentially the different types of culpability and mindsets that a perpetrator may have when carrying out a crime.
Can you talk a little bit about why this is a complicated issue for an international crime of ecocide?
Yeah, of course. So ecocide is essentially proposed as the fifth international crime within the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which is prosecuted in The Hague in the Netherlands. So at the moment, we've got genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes of aggression. And these were essentially the fundamental crimes of concern to humanity following the Nuremberg trials subsequent to World War II. International criminal law, then, it's essentially a step up from national law. It's these crimes which shock the conscience of humanity. As a result of this seriousness, some international criminal lawyers argue that a higher level of culpability and mindset is essentially required. Article 30 within the Rome Statute deals with the mental element of the core crimes and is the default standard, which if the definition doesn't define the mens rea, then this is the default standard that will be used. And this governs intent and knowledge. So you remember when I was talking about the different types of culpability? Intent and knowledge are essentially the most serious types of culpability, the strongest and most serious levels of mindset. Yet, when it comes to environmental damage, what we find is that oftentimes those higher levels of culpability aren't exactly met, and therefore is the default standard of the International Criminal Court, Article 30, intent and knowledge. Would that be sufficient in essentially offering the protection that the environment deserves within the context of the legal system? And so many advocates say that when it comes to defining the crime, what we should do is deviate from Article 30 and impose a slightly lower level of culpability within that definition. But at the same time, would this create political obstacles? The assembly of the parties within the International Criminal Court, would they prefer to have a higher level of culpability? Because obviously, the more protection of the environment, this could essentially curtail economic growth. And so these are just some of the considerations that we need to have in this sort of juxtaposition between a culpability standard, the most environmentally protective offering, compared to a politically acceptable and viable option.
So the issue is that most environmental harm is not created with an intent to cause that harm. It's more like a byproduct. However, yeah, as an international crime, there's a requirement for a heightened level of culpability, or at least potentially intent. Daryl, I'd love you to come in. You've thought about this problem, and of course, we're present at the drafting of the Rome Statute. How do you see this puzzle? What do you think is the way through for ecocide?
I think Luke said it well. The challenge, of course, is, in international criminal law, we want to have high thresholds because they're supposed to be serious crimes. But it's weird to talk about intention in relation to environmental damage, because people don't set out intending to destroy the environment. Usually they have some kind of profit motive or something else, and then it's a foreseen side effect. One of the ways out is what the panel did, which is they set a standard of knowing of a likelihood. That's pretty interesting, because knowing of a likelihood is a pretty serious level of fault, criminal law wise, and yet it's also feasible in an environmental case. So that's an interesting middle way between these two poles.
So I wonder, Luke, if you could outline the proposal that you make in your paper and then tell us how that applies to the Calao oil spill, and maybe just briefly explain what happened in that situation.
Yeah, so the Calao oil spill happened last January, and it's essentially been regarded as one of the largest ecocides to ever occur in Peru. At first, what the forecasts were was that the oil spill was caused by a volcanic eruption that occurred in Tonga, some hundreds of miles away, and that what this done was cause anomalous waves right across the ocean towards where this oil tanker was held by the company Respal in the Calao province of Calao. So at first, the Respal were pretty adamant, saying, no, we had absolutely nothing to do with it in terms of fault. You know, we had no intention to cause this oil spill. It was the waves. There was nothing we could have done, you know, to prevent the oil spill from occurring. But when I took a bit of a deeper inspection into the causes of the spill, what I found was that there was actually probably quite a high degree of fault on the part of this oil company. There was things in place such as poor contingency planning and preventative measures that if there was something like this to have been anticipated, you know, could it have been prevented if it was, you know, foreseen that this sort of thing could happen? There was faulty equipment, a poor leak detection system, rusted pipelines, which when the crash occurred, the rusted pipelines split way too easily. So that was one. There was poorly trained personnel. So there was nothing essentially that the personnel could have done in that situation because they didn't have the requisite degree of training to handle this sort of situation. And then I looked at what happened after the spill and the response from the company. What I found was that Restpol at the time were more concerned with covering it up rather than actually dealing with cleaning up the oil, which led to a high degree of oil being spilled and therefore had much more devastating ecological impacts. And so the approach that I sort of took was, well, was this an intentional act? Did Restpol intend to cause the oil spill? Of course, the answer is no. No one really essentially intends to cause an oil spill. Recklessness, applying the panel's definition, I thought, well, this probably isn't likely to be covered either. You know, was there foreseeable knowledge of likelihood? And I found, once again, probably not. Negligence, on the other hand, this could perhaps be, does this warrant a sort of culpable disregard for the sort of risks that could occur had Restpol not had these deficiencies in place? And that's when I thought, well, yeah, you know, this could be covered by negligence. And so from there, I sort of thought, well, oil spills often cause absolutely devastating ecological impacts to a similar extent in comparison to a lot of the other ecocides that have been sort of suggested in the literature. Yet, if recklessness and intention wouldn't be covered, then surely Restpol and other oil spills, BP Deepwater Horizon to an extent, would they just get away with it? So what I thought to do was introduce what I call the 3 degrees of ecocide. It's separating the crime into 3 distinct crimes in alignment with the different culpability standards that have been discussed throughout this podcast. So first degree ecocide would cover intent and knowledge ecocide, similarly to Article 30 of the Rome Statute. So this would cover times where there was an ecological destruction, essentially, that was caused when the consequences were a virtually certain result of the conduct. Of course, what we've talked about so far is that there'd be very limited times where this could occur and that the environmental damage was a virtually certain result. And so I said a secondary ecocide. So this would cover reckless ecocide. And this would essentially align with the panel's definition. And then third, you've got negligent ecocide, which would cover when there was a culpable disregard on the side of the perpetrator. And this level of disregard led eventually to the damage threshold and a crime taking place as a result. Now, where the essential disagreement between my proposal and the panel's definition is that I'm not exactly too sure at this moment in time whether the assembly of the parties would accept recklessness ecocide within the International Criminal Court. It's something that I'm undecided on. I'm not saying that it would never happen. And if they did, then I would sort of propose that recklessness do be included within the international criminal legal system. However, as a sort of backup plan, second and third degree ecocide, that being reckless and negligent ecocide, would simply be covered by national law, where you don't have these requirements for high levels of culpability. And it's essentially left to those national judicial systems. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, the 3 degrees of ecocide that I've sort of came up with.
Thanks so much, Luke. And if anyone wants to dive more into Luke's ideas, then his paper is on ecocidelaw.com. I want to turn to you now, Lisa, to your paper, which you co-author with Daryl. So you come at this question from a different angle in that you explore whether human rights due diligence can help with establishing the required mental state. So I think if I understand it correctly, you take the mental state as a given in the independent expert panel definition, but your approach was more about defining that better. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's essentially right.
You have a really long history of working in human rights, Lisa, and I think it's really interesting that you bring your human rights lens to bear on this question. Perhaps you could just start by telling us what human rights due diligence is.
So it's interesting. We're shifting to a different body of law from individual criminal responsibility, now looking to kind of essentially state responsibility under international human rights law. But I think it's really interesting in recent years that, you know, human rights law has kind of evolved to respond to corporate activity that threatens human rights and harms to the environment, both in a way that helps clarify responsibilities of business enterprises and business actors. and to require accountability where there are harms. So in our paper, we look at these developments and how they might offer guidance to clarify some of the elements of ecocide crime. And we zoomed in on this duty of due diligence, which essentially flows from the obligations that states have under human rights law to ensure protection against abuses by businesses, and the kind of corresponding corporate responsibility to respect human rights. In other words, under human rights law, businesses have to avoid causing or contributing to human rights harms and to remedy those harms where they do occur. And the duty of due diligence, as it's kind of evolved and is commonly understood, is reflected in what's called the UN Guiding Principles on Human Rights and Businesses that were developed over 10 years ago. And these guiding principles sort of help businesses proactively manage potential harms, human rights impacts, through this duty of due diligence. And basically, the duty has four core components. So it's a process, and it involves, first of all, assessing actual and potential human rights impacts. And then secondly, integrating the findings from impact assessments across the company's processes and taking appropriate action. Thirdly, then to track the effectiveness of those measures and processes to address the negative impacts. So to know whether they're working or not. And then finally, to communicate how the impacts are addressed. And so it's kind of a tool that's become a dominant regulatory tool. And, you know, a wide range of businesses recognize that where they adopt and implement effective due diligence, it's a means for them to raise the bar and also ensure sustainable business performance. So that's in a nutshell what the duty is.
And can you talk a little bit about how this has been used in relation to environmental harm? Because this is something that's coming from international human rights law. It's not immediately obvious how it relates to the environment.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, first of all, undertaking social and environmental impact assessments is recognized as a core part of this process. And that's because the corporate responsibility to protect human rights under these UN guiding principles applies to all internationally recognized human rights. And it's pretty widely acknowledged that corporate entities, you know, have been and continue to be responsible for human rights abuses related to climate, biodiversity, environmental damage, and so on. And in addition, you know, there are activities like rampant deforestation, chemical and plastic production, fossil fuel exploitation, and other sort of large scale extractive activities that directly jeopardize the newly recognized human right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment. We now have this as an autonomous human right recognized by the UN General Assembly. So it's a little bit clearer, I think, that those impacts, you know, that the duty of due diligence does have direct relevance to environmental harms.
Daryl, I'd love you to come in here. Maybe you can help us understand what's the problem in the crime of ecocide that this due diligence that Lisa's been outlining helps us address.
Right. Ecocide, it's trying to criminalize the worst violations of environmental law. A challenge with that is criminal law likes things to be clear. Environmental law has a lot of principles that have to be considered, balancing that has to be done. So it's not necessarily giving that concrete, knowable in advance clarity that we require for criminal law. Or sometimes environmental law, a lot of it depends on national regulation, and national regulation might differ from place to place. It might be really lax in some places, and we want a good, solid, clear standard that applies everywhere. What's interesting is, if a duty of environmental due diligence were to emerge, then that might help inject some clarity into the crime of ecocide. Ecocide could require a breach of the duty of environmental due diligence. And if it did that, there would be some identifiable standards, because human rights law gives us a fair bit of clarity of what is expected of someone to show due diligence. It also provides a consistent standard across countries. So it's an interesting possibility to clarify ecocide.
Can you talk a bit more about how it helps with the mental element?
Yeah, one of the concerns with definitions of ecocide, for example, the panel one, it talks about knowing of a substantial likelihood of the harm. And so then one of the concerns is, well, what if someone says, oh, I didn't know there would be harm because I didn't bother even doing any impact assessment at all? Then technically that person's off the hook because they didn't have knowledge of the harm. And yet failing to do any impact assessment at all is itself an egregious breach of your duties of environmental stewardship. In criminal law, we usually think that knowing is worse than not knowing, but that's not always true. We have to ask, why is it that you didn't know? If you're about to embark on a really dangerous, high-impact activity, you have a duty to carry out an impact assessment. So if someone didn't even bother with the impact assessment, that in itself shows a level of disdain for the harm that is probably a culpable attitude, equally serious as knowing about it. So again, having a breach of a duty of due diligence is, I think, potentially really clever because it includes both the person who knew about the harm and proceeded anyways, and also the person who didn't care about the harm.
Thanks. Lisa, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I think just to Daryl's point, it's really interesting. I mean, one of the weaknesses, I think, that we need to acknowledge in the human rights due diligence sort of framework is that, at least historically, you know, it's been considered a voluntary regime. It, you know, these are guiding principles that are derived from law, but unless they are translated into mandatory, you know, obligations at the national level or at the regional level, which they are in the process of doing at the European level, at least, then they are basically, the risk is that these can be kind of box ticking process oriented frameworks. And I think that it's important that we don't put too much hope and faith that these, unless they are enshrined and sort of recognized as mandatory measures, that they are going to kind of take us much further. But I think it's interesting because we are seeing the shift towards mandatory, and the demand is coming from both the business side, where there's a recognition that we want a level playing field. We want all businesses to have the same obligations to do this sort of proper stewardship that Daryl was talking about through mandatory measures.
Yeah, I completely agree with Lisa that this idea of due diligence only works if some kind of standard of due diligence becomes mandatory. There's a couple ways that could happen. One is through legislation, due diligence legislation, which we're seeing in some countries. The other is human rights courts are starting to develop idea of due diligence. And the third one is maybe environmental law will inject an idea of due diligence. So yeah, I completely agree. It's an interesting avenue, but it does require some kind of binding duty of due diligence.
This is more of a question rather than a comment, but if a mandatory due diligence was incorporated into national laws and then a company fails to abide by them or go ahead with the due diligence, would that contribute towards proving unlawfulness within the panel's definition? So unlawful or wanton acts. Would it be unlawful, therefore, to have breached your due diligence requirements? And could that help with the prosecution?
Yeah, I think it could. And again, that's one of the other, here's another challenge in with the crime of ecocide. Most of international environmental law, when it lays down rules, it's speaking to states. States, mm-hmm. You have to keep your emission of this substance within this boundary. It's tricky. Yes, I should back up a notch and explain the unlawful requirement. So yeah, in the panel definition, one of the ways for environmental harm to be wrongful is if it's unlawful. So it's unlawful in international law or it's unlawful in domestic law. But one thing that occurs to me is to what extent is some private company, to what extent are they supposed to be experts in international environmental law? A lot of them wouldn't necessarily know it. So again, that duty of due diligence bridges the gap because what should we expect from private companies? What's the fair level to expect from them? And the answer is due diligence. They should show due diligence in finding out what the rules are. So I think due diligence can also help it with that test as well.
So one thing that strikes me in listening to you talk about using the standard of due diligence is that I suppose in order to be culpable, in order to be guilty of an international crime, you would have to do more than fail in your due diligence requirements, right? I mean, there's a gap between these two standards. I don't know, Lisa or Daryl, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Go ahead, Daryl. This is something we have talked about, because I think this is there's a lot more work to be done to kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah, it's a really good point. The competing things is you know, those of us who want to maximize environmental protection, we want to make our crime as easy to prove as possible. But on the other hand, if it's supposed to be an international crime with the highest stigma, we do need a high level of fault. So probably it's not enough if a country just if a company made one mistake in due diligence, that probably that if they made that one mistake, that would trigger their civil responsibility. They might be liable in torts. They might have made a human rights violation or some other environmental law violation. But it probably needs to be a somewhat worse error for it to be an international crime. There's a difference we draw in the common law between negligence and criminal negligence. And it might be something like that. Negligence is just if I make a mistake in how I built my baseball diamond and someone got hurt. Criminal negligence requires that I did a bad job, but it has to be a really bad job that warrants being punished. So probably that's correct. There has to be a criminally negligent breach of due diligence would make sense.
Thanks. Okay. Well, and again, if people want to dive more into the ideas that Lisa and Daryl have been talking about, then you can check out their paper on the Ecocide Law site. Before we finish, I wanted to come back to the standard proposed by the independent expert panel, which Luke talked about earlier when he started us off. And Daryl, you reflected that this standard, which could be characterized as recklessness or knowledge of a substantial risk, you thought that that was about right for the international crime. I'm just curious to go back to Luke and Lisa and see if they have thoughts about whether that is the right standard for an international crime of ecocide.
This is something that I'm slightly conflicted on. On the one hand, I completely agree and sympathize to the arguments that it's very rare that there are environmental crimes committed with intent and knowledge. But then I would say that if recklessness was to be incorporated, I think potentially that could be justified by having perhaps a slightly higher damage threshold, because it would sort of bring about an enormous gravity of a crime if there was recklessness and a really high degree of damage, which is what ecocide essentially intends to criminalise anyways. And so if we can get the political support around a crime of recklessness, which I think over the last year since I've actually brought this paper, I think we're beginning to see more of it. When you look at things like the European Law Institute's definition, they've incorporated recklessness into their definition. And so if this gathers support, then it's likely that eventually, if ecocide was to become an international crime, that would be the standard that was incorporated. And so, yeah, I think if we can get the political support behind it, then it's something that I absolutely support. Otherwise, I would suggest utilising national law as a sort of backup in order to sort of accommodate the different types of culpability.
Lisa?
Yeah, I don't have too much to add. I agree with what Luke has just said. I think sort of just zooming out, though, it's interesting to reflect on where we are kind of in a timeline of history, and that to me, the definition is appropriate and that standard is appropriate because of where we're at today and the knowledge that exists of the impact of ecocides. You know, maybe 15 years ago, that standard would be harder to sort of justify, but I think it's today, you know, we have attribution science, we have an awareness of the impacts of these criminal acts, basically, that we mightn't have had 15 or 20 years ago. So I think just kind of contextualizing it, for me, it's an appropriate standard, although maybe politically a difficult one to push across the line.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. As a reminder to people listening, this podcast is one in a series of conversations around different aspects of the proposed new international crime of ecocide. The series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium on the same topic, which you can find on ecocidelaw.com. Each of our interviewees on the podcast has authored one of the 15 short papers on the site on issues ranging from how ecocide applies to bauxite mining in Jamaica or to international wildlife crime, to how it might be best brought into law, contribute to environmental justice, or interact with the rights of nature. The site also hosts a regularly updated annotated bibliography, which lists and summarises publications on ecocide, as well as information on the proposed definition and legal developments around the world. So if you want to know more, visit ecocidelaw.com.
Look for the Promise Institute on social media. You can find us under the handle @PromiseInst, UCLA, And please consider supporting our work by making a donation. Visit law.ucla.edu/supportpromise to contribute at any level and help make conversations like these possible. Last thing, make sure you're subscribed to the show to be sure to catch future episodes. Until next time, take care.